Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Happy to have you along today as we begin the show by taking a look at the role of physics in our everyday life. Why it's hard to get ketchup out of a bottle, maybe we can talk about, or what a bubble bath teaches us about surface tension. And we're going to do that by talking on the phone from the UK with Helen Chersky, a physicist at University College London's Department of Mechanical Engineering. She's a science presenter for the BBC. She writes a monthly column for BBC Focus magazine. It's called Everyday Science. And we're going to be talking about her new book. It's called Storm in a Teacup, The Physics of Everyday Life. There may be some laws of physics that fascinate you, or maybe you've got a question about some thing that you do every day, and what are the physics behind it? I hope you'll join in our conversation. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@wpr.org, or go ahead and post on the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. We'd love to hear from you. And Helen Chersky, welcome to the show. Thanks for taking time to be with us.
You're very welcome.
I tell you, I hope you sell 5 million copies of this book.
Well, I hope I do too.
I could open the book anywhere to any page and find something that I would just bang my forehead and say, "Oh, that's how it works." It's wonderful. Your delight in physics and physics in everyday life shines through in virtually every page. And I thought it was kind of an interesting story that you tell in the beginning about how you got interested in physics.
Well, thank you for your enthusiasm. Yeah, so is the story you're talking about the one referring to my nana? There's so many stories, it's hard to tell. I'll tell you about my nana. So I come from the north of England, and the people there are very down to earth and very practical. And when I did a physics degree at Cambridge, and I was revising for an exam once at my nana's house, and she's a little northern lady. She's not had much formal education, but she's bright. You know, she's sharp, and she looked at what I was revising, which was quantum mechanics. And she, you know, it looks like hieroglyphics. And she said, "What's that?" And I said, "It's quantum mechanics, Nana." And I tried to explain a little bit about it. And she looked very impressed. And then she said, "Oh, and what can you do when you know that?" And that is a very good question. And I think that, you know, physicists don't think about that often enough, is that, you know, there's all these equations that look very impressive. But fundamentally, what people really usually want to know is, what can you do when you know that? And so I couldn't really answer Nana at the time. And I guess the book has turned into a very long answer several years later. I've always been a very practical person, interested in how the world worked. And I did, you know, my physics degrees, and I'm a professional physicist now. And then I realized that most people don't see the world like that, and no one talks about it, and all this fun you can have with all the things, you know, just around us. And so I thought I would talk about it.
Well, it just gives you a whole different look at the things you do every day.
Well, it starts from the point that, you know, so we walk around in the world, and we actually know, we have a lot of observations. You know, all of us, every time you pick something up or you drop something or you can't get ketchup out of the bottle, that's a little data point of some sort. And it's just, once you sort of lay the framework on top, then you see the patterns, and then you see that, you know, that what stops ketchup coming out of the bottle or makes it come out very quickly isn't just that one thing. It's also, you know, also speeds up and slows down snails and affects how toothpaste comes out of tubes. And it's the same pattern happens in lots and lots of places. And so it's fun, because you take these things and they become tools, and then you just walk around with them and you see them everywhere.
And, you know, I hadn't thought much about gravity lately until I read your book, and I'm looking at, oh, when you were talking about measuring or weighing flour, what's really going on there is gravity, as an example.
Yeah, so there's a, you know, no one really ever mentions this, but I know in America you use cups more, because I lived in the States for a while, and all my recipe books from that time are in cups of flour and cups of sugar. We tend to weigh things a little bit more over here. But when you know, if you weigh out some number of ounces or grams of flour, the scale doesn't work by itself. It only works because you've got some flour in a bowl, but you've also got a planet that's pulling on you, and it's pulling the flour towards it. And all the scales are doing is basically getting in the way between the planet and the flour and measuring the squish, which is those two things pulling on each other. So, you know, when you have a recipe book, really it should say you need flour, eggs, butter, milk, and a planet. Because you can't measure anything by using scales unless you've got something planet-sized to do the pulling. So, you know, we just use it all the time, but that's what the scales are really doing.
At the top of the show, I mentioned stirring milk into coffee was like cold and warm air mixing. Explain how that works.
Well, so I, living here in Britain and also at some latitudes towards the north side of North America, you get these big rotating storms that are mixing, so especially cold air, cold polar air in our case, with warmer air from the south. And, you know, in general, the cold air stays in the north and the warm air stays in the south. And just about the level, the line of the jet stream around the planet, that's kind of where the boundary between the cold and the warm air is. And we see these big rotating storms. And they just, you know, for us, they're just big storms going around and around. But you can sort of see what's going on when you pour a little bit of cream into your coffee or milk into your tea, for those of us that live in England and put milk in our tea. And then as you stir it, what you see is a swirl, which is very interesting because what doesn't happen is that the hot milk and the cold milk don't just kind of merge straight into each other. You know, if you had a crowd, like a football crowd, for example, and you had half with jerseys that were one color and half with jerseys that were the other color, and you sort of let them go and let them wander, they just kind of merge into each other. But the liquid doesn't do that. It swirls around in a kind of spiral, and you see that in your teacup. And the atmosphere is the same. That's how fluids mix. They mix by swirling. So up in the atmosphere, when these big rotating storms happen, you get the cold air from the north and the warm air from the south, and they mix in a swirl. So you see the same kind of swirl in your teacup that you get on an enormous scale in the sky, but it happens for the same reason, that that's how fluids mix together. So that's why the book's called Storm in a Teacup, because you can, you know, you can look at your teacup and look at this swirling, and then out here in the UK, you can look up at the sky and see the same thing happening above you on an enormous scale.
Same thing that's happening in your teacup. That's
Well, it's, you know, that's the nice thing. It's all about patterns. So physics is a great topic. I'm obviously an enthusiast, but I'm enthusiastic about it because it is about patterns, that there are a relatively small number of patterns, actually, that get you a very, very long way in the world. And so once you learn about what liquids do, you see it again and again and again. And perhaps, I mean, my favorite example is the laws about how gases behave. So, you know, you can watch popcorn pop, and that happens because when the popcorn kernel heats up, the water that's inside the kernel evaporates, it becomes a gas, and it's stuck inside that kernel because it's a hard shell. And as you heat it up, you give it energy, and the molecules move about faster, and that creates pressure. So you increase the pressure, and eventually, of course, the kernel gives up, and the whole thing turns itself inside out with a bit of a whoosh as the pressure is released. But the same bit of physics that explains the popcorn also explains the internal combustion engine, for example, and how hot air balloons work and why cake rises, and how whales breathe as they go down deep in the ocean. And so you start with, what's nice about this is that you start with one little thing and it leads outwards, and it's not just that it's not just about toys. You know, I'm a great fan of playing with the world around us, but it's not just about the sort of little trivial things. The same thing then also explains how a rocket works and how we might get to the moon, and, you know, these big questions about how our, the infrastructure of our civilization works. They're all based on the same physics that you get in, you know, eggs in the kitchen and cups of tea, and so we've all got the experience to put the pieces together, and all you have to do is join the dots. And it is quite, what's nice about the experimentation as well is that you can play with it for yourself, and then you really remember it. I had there's an example in the book where So if you're the sort of person that boils an egg and then puts it back in the fridge, which I'm told some people do this, but you can tell whether your egg is raw or boiled without taking the shell off. And the way you do it is you lay the egg down on its side. It's quite good if you do it with a raw one, the boiled one at the same time. And you set it spinning. And then you just put your finger very briefly on top of the egg. And a different thing happens depending on whether it's raw or boiled. And I'm not going to tell you what it is because I really would love your audience to rush to their fridges and go and get some eggs and try this out. Anyway, so I was doing this. I did this demonstration at an event for some adults once, and it was a sort of corporate event. They were all very posh. And I didn't tell them either what was going on. I said, come up and ask me afterwards. Afterwards, I had all these, you know, men in business suits literally tugging on my sleeve saying, is it this? Is it this? And when I listened and I'd say, yes, you got it right, they'd go, yes! You know, there's this enormous joy that comes out from having worked it out. And I'm sure, you know, most people, even though they've never seen the thing of the eggs, will see what happens and they'll get it right. So you set the egg spinning, let it spin, just touch your finger very, very briefly on the top and then take it away. And that same bit of physics also explains, you know, how telescopes in space can always stay pointed in the same direction and why bikes stay up and that kind of thing. But it's like the joy, you know, that moment, and everyone can have that, you know, you don't need science degrees and all this, you know, there's also obviously lots to learn, but you don't need, you know, humans are good at working things out. And I think everyone should just have the confidence to sort of play with the world around them and then, you know, work it out. And it's just that habit, you know, instead of walking away from it, you walk towards it and poke it a bit and say, oh, you know, I wonder why that is.
Well, Sullivan in Green Bay has a question for you, so let's go there.
All right, so this is probably going to be a little bit more advanced than what the show is originally about, but I had heard that a rumor a couple of years ago that there potentially are cold fusion reactors for nuclear power plants. Is this true? And if so, how would they work?
Okay, so cold fusion is it's a sort of very important topic for society. So for people who don't think about cold fusion quite as much as you do, what powers the sun is nuclear fusion. It's the components of atoms joining together and releasing energy as they do it. And our nuclear reactors, the current ones, work by taking very big middle bits, very big atoms, and breaking them apart, and that gives out a bit of energy. You want to, the middle state is where everything's stable. So if you're bigger than it, you can release energy by going towards the middle, and if you're smaller than it, you can release energy by going towards the middle. So our nuclear power reactors work by breaking big atoms up, but if we could do cold fusion, which is to start with relatively room temperature atom components and put them together to fuse and give off energy, that would be an amazing power source. The problem is it takes quite a lot of a kick to get it going. So the issue with cold fusion is that, you know, it happens in the sun because the sun is very hot and very dense and there's lots of energy and there's enough kind of starter energy to get the whole thing going. Just like you need to start your car, you know, you need a bit of starter energy. So cold fusion at the moment, it has been done, but only in massive experimental reactors. So there's a place called the National Ignition Facility in, I think it's in California. I've been there. I think it's in somewhere in California. And they have got a way where you can, you know, you can fuse things together to get a little bit more energy out than you put in. But basically, no one's really cracked exactly how to do it. So I don't think there are cold fusion reactors now. I do think there are various technologies that might make it possible. However, fusion has always been 40 years away. You know, for the past 80 years, fusion has been 40 years away. So we can look at the sun and we can see how much energy it gives out. We can see the principle at work, but we're not quite in control of it yet. And actually, that's one of the few things that it is quite hard to experiment with in your kitchen. There's very few principles that you can't have a little bit of a play with in the everyday world. But fusion is one of them. Just you do need to be engineering on the scale of atoms moving extremely quickly to get it to work. There's a lot of very interesting physics in it, but I don't think we're quite at cold fusion yet. It might be less than 40 years, though.
Okay. Ellen Chersky, our guest today, she is the author of Storm in a Teacup, The Physics of everyday life. I'm Larry Mueller. Jill Nador, on-air producer here on the Ideas Network. Right now, we're visiting with Helen Chersky, physicist at University College London's Department of Mechanical Engineering and author of Storm in a Teacup, The Physics of Everyday Life. Join in with your own questions or comments at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. We'd love to hear from you. And you know, Helen, last night we had quite a storm go through a good share of Wisconsin, and there was lightning and thunder, and I was thinking about your book and lightning and the sounds of lightning, and I was fascinated by your description of the different sounds in perhaps one bolt of lightning.
Oh, yeah. So lightning's brilliant because it's sort of listening to thunder is slightly like time travel in quite an interesting way. So, light travels extremely quickly. So when you get the flash of lightning, so there's this tube that connects the ground into a cloud, and that tube basically becomes plasma, which emits a very fast burst of light. So that happens extremely quickly, almost instantly. But then thunder is interesting because the sound travels much more slowly. So you see this often, you know, if you're at a baseball game or something, you will see the ball being hit before you hear it, and that's because the light reaches you. The light and the sound happen at the same time. They start at the same time, but they take different amounts of time to actually get to you. So the thing about a lightning bolt is that there's quite a lot of it going from the ground up, you know, a couple of miles into the cloud. And so the sound from the ground reaches you first. And then as the thunder rumbles on, what you're hearing is the sound from higher and higher up. So you're kind of hearing up as you go, up the lightning bolt. And the cool thing about that is that the sound changes as it comes through the air. And the more air it's gone through, the more it's changed. So early on, when you hear that sharp crack, that's the lightning closest to the ground that's basically come straight at you. All the sound arrives at once, and it's very sharp and quick. And then as you carry on, as you hear up the lightning bolt, because the sound has traveled through more and more air as it's coming at more and more of an angle, you hear that the high frequencies, the high notes, that very sharp crack, that gets taken away by the air. It gets dissipated. And you're left with the low notes. And so there's this kind of filtering process that the longer you listen for, the more the air has filtered out the high sounds and just left you with the low ones. So that's why thunder gets kind of a bit deeper as you go, is you're hearing higher and higher up the cloud, because more and more of the high frequencies have been taken away. So you can actually directly hear, just standing in one place, what the air does to sound. So low sounds travel much further generally than high sounds. And you can actually hear it happening in thunder, which doesn't necessarily help if you're standing outside in the rain trying not to get wet. But, you know, if you are stuck on that horrible day, you can at least stand in your shed or in your, you know, look out at the miserable weather and, you know, just appreciate the scale of what's happening around you. It's all there.
It was a delight for me to know why those sounds were different, because I had just read about it in your book. And that's one of the cool things about the book. You know, you do some everyday thing or hear some everyday sound, and oh, that's why it's happening.
Yeah, I have to. You do. It is a bit sort of sticky. It does come back at odd times. I walk around in the world just kind of. I do play with things quite a lot. My neighbors and my sister are always being asked to come and play. You know, we're going to try this. We're going to see how well we can make milk foam or something like that. And the thing is that you can try a lot for yourself. But it's not just about knowing the answers. So the important thing is that if you know a little bit of the framework, you know, these quite fundamental things about how the world works, there's lots of variety inside them. But if you know the fundamental rules, what it lets you do is not necessarily always know the answer, but it lets you ask the right question. And that's the important bit. And sometimes you can answer that question, you know, by making some milk foam or trying to dye a rose blue or something like that. But sometimes it just lets you ask the question to somebody else. You know, if someone's trying to sell you something, for example, and they say, oh, it can do this thing. And if you know a little bit about those patterns, you can say, oh, but this is the question that doesn't, you know, this is the bit in your story where you're trying to sell me something that doesn't quite make sense. And you know which question to ask. And it's the same, you know, in any situation where you've got to evaluate information, you need to know the framework so that you know what to ask. And I think that's what's really important, that the play side of it is a lot of fun. But, you know, as citizens, we live in a world which is constantly asking us to make decisions. And just knowing a little bit makes you, it stops you being helpless. And these everyday toys are the gateway to not being helpless. And that's the really important bit, I think.
Yeah, I agree. Mike in Madison has something for us. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Larry. Hi, Helen. I'm certainly enjoying this. I used to run the Wonders of Physics program at UW-Madison. I now have my own company to go out and encourage kids to learn about their world. And I applaud your book. I can't wait to go get a copy of it and look through it. I wanted to comment on one of your earlier callers was talking about fusion. University of Madison, UW-Madison did a lot of research on fusion energy. I had a fusion reactor just down the hall from my office. And I did a lot of plasma physics outreach. And you're absolutely correct. You can't do fusion in your kitchen, but you can do a really wonderful analogy. It's called fusion cookies. And all you need is some cookie dough, microwave-safe plate, a scale that's accurate down to milligrams, a microwave, and, of course, a planet, as you mentioned earlier about scales. I was listening. Anyway, if you put two lumps of cookie dough on a plate and weigh it, those lumps of cookie dough represent hydrogen atoms. You weigh them, you get the mass, you put it in the microwave, cook it for about a minute, and believe it or not, you can actually make very nice cookies in a microwave. And as they cook, they spread out, the dough spreads out, and they fuse together. Now you've got one kind of odd-shaped cookie, but that represents a helium atom. And some mass, and then you reweigh it, and some mass has been lost. Well, that actually is just water vapor from the cookies, but the analogy is that's the mass that's lost in the fusion process. It gets turned to energy. Then just for fun, you can plug that mass loss into E equals MC squared. You can calculate the amount of energy that would have been released if that were an actual fusion process. And then you get to eat the cookies.
Any experiment where you get to eat the cookies at the end is a good one in my book.
Yeah.
So I hadn't heard that analogy before. But it's nice. What's nice, I guess, is that you can do the calculation. I mean, E equals MC squared is it's this famous equation. But the fact that it's in that form is so simple does actually mean that anyone with a calculator could work out, you know, if you could turn this much mass instantly into energy, how much energy would that be? And it's a huge number. So it's great if you could do that with cookie dough.
We gave people a conversion chart, like converting into how many gallons of gasoline equivalent would that be, so they could take whatever number they could calculate, like how many gallons of gasoline, how many pounds of TNT. I mean, make it into units that would be more realistic, because most people can't wrap their head around joules.
Well, you know, the other thing you can do if you're making cookies is, you know, so in E equals MC squared, right, you've just provided the M, but the microwave can also provide you with C. You can measure the speed of light using a microwave. And the way you do it is you take a flat plate, plastic plate, and kind of spread out little chocolate drops or something on it, stick them in the microwave for a bit so you don't want them to turn. And what you'll see is that a pattern pops up, and the chocolate will all melt in some places and not in others. And that's because you've set up something called a standing wave in the microwave. So if you measure the distance between the bits that have melted, you can measure the wavelength of the microwaves. And on the back of the microwave, there is the frequency the microwave is working at. And if you multiply those two things together, you will get the speed of light. So you can directly measure the speed of light for yourself in your kitchen, which is quite nice.
Which is quite nice.
And surprisingly accurate. I mean, routinely within about 10%
right.
Accurate.
Mike, thank you so much. I'm really glad you called. Oh, boy. Well, Jeremy in La Crosse has a question.
Hi there.
And it's covered in your book as well. So, Jeremy, what's your question?
Well, I'm a chef, and I work constantly with refrigeration, and it either makes the day or breaks the day based on how well it's sending your food. And I've always wondered the difference between anhydrous ammonia and Freon and what other possibilities there could be as a refrigerant, and how and where the energy is conserved and lost, or how that interacts behind the scenes of the refrigerator.
Yeah.
So it's not. So the chemistry is a whole different complicated thing again. The interesting thing about a fridge, though, is that, so there's this general, generally in physics, things, heat energy goes from the hot stuff to the cold stuff. That's the way things go. But what a fridge does is really clever. It uses another law of physics, which says that the overall disorder in the universe, the messiness of the universe, will always increase. And so it makes a cold place. It gets around the rule that things will always go from hot to cold by creating disorder. There's kind of another bit somewhere else where you can't. Sorry, someone's just knocked on the door of my office. You can go from you can take energy. You can get around. You can make energy go from cold to hot as long as you're creating more disorder elsewhere. And so the different refrigerants you have that run around the back of you. That's why opening the fridge door never makes the room colder, because you have to create more heat outside in order to get some cold inside. So different refrigerants that you mentioned, the Freons and the anhydrous ammonia, they have different efficiencies at expanding and cooling as they go around the back of the fridge. And so basically they work best on different scales and in different, different ways, different efficiencies. So I guess it depends on your fridge exactly which one's better. But the game with them is that you compress them and expand them, and they will take in and give out heat. And then you can move that heat around in a compressed state and release it somewhere else. But a fridge is an interesting thing to play with. But I wouldn't advise taking one apart. That's because they're not nice chemicals generally, which is sad. I think it's sad when you can't see into things and you can't take things apart. Like those two things. What I really want in the kitchen is, and I'm sure someone makes this and it's probably horrendously expensive, I want everything to be see-through. Like, I want a toaster that is transparent so you can see the toast getting toasted. And I want, mixers and things where you can see inside the engine and watch the bits going round. There aren't enough transparent kitchen devices. And a fridge would be a great one, because you would see the fluid condensing and then expanding again on the other side. And you would see it pumped around this cycle, taking in heat in one place and giving it out somewhere else.
Oh, that's great. Jeremy, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. And lots of callers online with questions for you. But I wanted to ask, you mentioned toasters, and I read your description of what goes on inside a toaster, and I had a much simpler view of what happens in a toaster than how you describe. I mean, you don't describe it in a very. I mean, it's easy to understand as you talk about it, but I certainly wasn't aware of what goes on.
Well, the toaster's lovely. So I tend to think, so I'm very, being northern and very down to earth, I think that before people worry about the universe and the cosmology and, what the galaxy is doing, I think people should understand their toaster, because a toaster's got a lot of fundamental physics in it, and most people have one in their kitchen. So there's two things in a toaster that demonstrate two really, really, like, of all the laws of physics, these are some of the most fundamental. And one of them is that things that are hot radiate away energy. So anything that has a temperature is giving it away. Basically, you can't stop that process. And it's a rule of the universe that if something is hot, it's going to be giving energy away. And it gives it away in the form of light, but we can't always see that light. So in a toaster, the element that gets hot heats up a lot. And so it gives its energy away, and it's so hot that it gives it away in light that we can see. So that's the orange and the red glow. But you and I are glowing in the infrared, because we're not quite as hot as the toaster element. So we give away light that's slightly less energetic. So it's in the infrared and our eyes can't see it, but we are light bulbs and we're giving off light all the time that we can't see, which is why, you know, one of the reasons we get cold. So you can see that process in your toaster, and, you know, in the sun, and as you heat, as the element gets hotter and hotter and hotter and it gets closer to yellow, it's just giving away a different frequency of light. So it's giving away different colors. And the sun, of course, is far, far hotter, and so that gives out white light because it's giving out all the colors. So toasters demonstrate that this law of black body radiation, it's called, that things give away heat. But they also demonstrate the relationship between electricity and magnetism, because when you push down the lever on the side of the toaster, it sticks to the there's a little electromagnet in there, so the current that's running through the wire has a little iron core, and that makes a magnet. When you change a current close to something that is iron, you turn it into a magnet. And so the lever sticks by magnetism down at the bottom. That's why if you push the lever down when you not plug the toaster in, it doesn't stick, it doesn't go anywhere. But as soon as the current is running, you make a little electromagnet, and then when the toaster has done its toasting, it switches the current to the electromagnet off, and the lever pops back up. So right in there in the toaster, you've got black body radiation and electromagnetism. Yes, great story.
It's a great story. I love it. Gail in Fish Creek, your turn. Hi, Gail.
Hi. I want to thank your guest for writing this book, because I really think that every parent should buy this book for their child before they're even in school and start a weekly study of all of it, because I think it will help them in the way that Richard Feynman had suggested back in the 80s. And I know I've mentioned this on different shows when I called in about education and creativity, but they had suggested changing our curriculum in the U.S. to teach children the basic fundamentals of physics before they teach them even how to add numbers, even doing any math, because it will help them to comprehend and assimilate and ask the questions we need to ask now. So we've missed out on 30 years of that being done, but now I think her book should be an educational read for every kid, whether it's put in school or not. And thank you so much.
You're very welcome. So I think adults can play too. One of the things I think is that adults have forgotten to play with the world. So I'm all for kids playing, but I think adults are allowed. It's okay. If anyone needs permission, go and play with your dinner, because it's justified by physics. So I think adults are allowed to play too. But I think it is very important that kids are familiar with how to experiment. The idea that you have a question, you don't know how something works, and you can try it two ways. You can do it, you know, you can maybe plant your seed in the sunlight and plant it out of the sunlight and see what the difference is. And that's the habit that's a really good thing to get at early, is how is this process of, that, you know, we can collect evidence. We can do a little experiment to see which one is actually, which idea is true. And I think that's the really good habit, to think about what could happen, because that's always the first thing, and then to come up with an experiment to see which one does happen. And that sort of thing, I think, would be a great habit. It's when people stop playing, you know, kids kind of, at a certain age, kind of feel like they're not allowed to play with the world anymore. And so adults feel they're not allowed to. And I think everyone should be allowed to. I'm not proud. You know, I'm an adult, and I am perfectly happy to spend my time, you know, doing daft experiments. And you know what? What's interesting, when it's my neighbor or my sisters or whoever it is who gets to join in, is they all laugh at me, but they all secretly want to be involved. They're up for it, but they don't feel that society kind of, you know, they feel it's not the sort of thing adults should do. And I'm up for changing that.
I agree with you 100%. And one final, we've got a show coming up on fish and preparing fish. And you have a great story about what happens when you fry something, be it fish or something else, and what's really going on with the material that you're frying.
Oh, yeah. So this is one of those things that everyone's seen and no one really thinks about, right, which is, why do things sizzle? Because that's weird, right? You put a piece of onion, in some hot oil, and it starts to sizzle. And everyone just takes that for granted. And there is a reason. And the reason is that the onion has water in it. And what happens is, as soon as you put it in something hot, you know, the water evaporates. It forms a gas. But a gas takes up quite a lot of space, so it has to go somewhere. So what it does is it pushes out of the onion in little bubbles. And it's the sound of those bubbles escaping, which is the sizzling that you hear. So that's why when you fry wetter food, you get more of a sizzle, because there's more water vapor, more gas to be got rid of. And it's just a little thing, but it's quite nice to know why it happens.
And why, and the fact that the pores, when you have the hot oil, if the oil is hot enough, it really does not enter the material itself, the meat or whatever it is.
Yeah, so if you don't want to make it soggy, then, because soggy, if you fry something and it's soggy, it's because the oil was too cool, so it could go into the onion before the gas could push it back out. So if it's super, super hot, the gas evaporates really quickly and it pushes out really quickly, and basically the oil never gets anywhere near the actual onion, so it can't soak in. But if your oil is too cool, then the oil can get in because the gas isn't pushing it out quickly enough. And so that's why if you don't want soggy food, you should make sure your oil is hot enough.
Helen, you've written a wonderful book, and it's I do hope that a lot of people read it. And then there are so many things we haven't talked about. We didn't get to the ketchup or why pigeons bob their heads when they walk, or this whole business about Adams. My daughter took great delight in asking me, Dad, why can't you trust Adams? And I said, I don't know why. And she said, because they make up everything. And that was, and I'm concluding on that terrible note, but the book's great. Thank you so much, Helen, for being with us today.
Thanks for having me on.
I hope we have a chance to talk again. Helen Chersky, a physicist at University College London's Department of Mechanical Engineering. If you want to have a fun time, take a look at Storm in a Teacup. That's the title of her book, Storm in a Teacup. The Physics of Everyday Life. And the author is Helen Chersky. Her name is, her last name is spelled CZERSKI. And we have it up on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. You can take a look at it there.